Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer. Good evening, Richard.
Good evening. Nice to be here.
All right. Tonight, our guest is going to be Bob Loeb. He's a gambling attorney based out of Chicago. He's going to be on with us in less than 15 minutes. And the news of the week, this is especially for those of you who want to play in next year's World Series of Poker, but feel that the formerly highest entry fees of $10,000 or $50,000 was just too low to get you excited. Boy, do we have good news for you. There will now be a $1 million entry fee tournament. One ninth of that entry fee is going to a charity called One Drop, which is a good charity set up to ensure people around the world have clean water to drink. It's a bracelet event. As of Tuesday, there were 22 players agreeing to pony up the $1 million, including some big names: Danny Negreanu, Gus Hansen, Tom Dwan, Johnny Chan, Elke, Patrick Antonius, several others. Well, you only have to beat a few dozen other pros to win this bracelet. These pros are pretty strong players. What do you think about this, Munch? Are you planning to enter?
Not unless I get a sponsor. in addition to those really strong players, there are also some very wealthy, shall we say, not so strong players.
That's true.
Guy Liberté, the guy behind all the Cirque du Soleil shows, I guess he was really instrumental in getting this event done, and he's a big proponent of that charity. So it's great they're raising a lot of money for charity. The pros, not only do they have some of these billionaires, Ruffinas in it, there's some dead money in there as well. So maybe they're not playing, even though they're giving up 10% to the charity, maybe they're not really playing without it. Maybe they're still gambling with an edge, shall we say.
I can't believe that. If there were, it's just hard to believe that anybody would have 11% edge. Over.
Yeah, I guess it'll depend on how many non-pros are in there and versus how many pros. But certainly, whoever wins this thing is going to get a lot of other benefits other than just the money. I mean, the kind of endorsement deals they'll be able to make after winning this $1 million event will be huge. And probably anybody who's even entered in it, will have potential for endorsement deals.
Yeah, well, like anybody who's entered it doesn't need the endorsement deals. They're already quite wealthy.
Well, yeah.
when you talk about $1 million, we're out of the price range of most of us. But so trying to translate it into numbers that still represents 11% going to charity, it's like how many of us would enter a slot tournament, strictly luck, no skill, where your equity was $800, but it cost you $900 to enter. And you were told that extra $100 would go to a good charity. How many of you would enter? Now, at the level, among the low-level players, most of us are only going to enter these events if we have an edge. And giving up 11% off the top is pretty steep.
Right. But a slot tournament is... I'm sure every one of these guys thinks that they're better than everybody else, I think, right? I don't think anybody's going into it thinking, well, I'm not a favorite here. I mean, maybe the wealthy guys, you know, like Ruffin and Guy Liberté or whatever. But of the pros, I'm sure they all go in thinking they're the favorite, you know.
You don't think they have pretty heavy respect for the other ones in there?
I think they respect them, but you know, it reminds me they have a in backgammon they have this thing called the Giant 32, and they send out ballots to name who the top players are in the world. And when they first started it, they realized that every one of the top players they sent the ballot to always put themselves at the top of the list. So they made a rule and said, you know, make your list of the top 32, but put yourself at number two. You know, it's funny. I know one particular high-profile backgammon player who just couldn't bear to put anybody above himself on the list. So he listed a computer program as the only player that would be above him on the list.
Did the other pros agree with his assessment and put him number one?
No.
Well, could be. I would think Phil Hellmuth is going to get into this. He's desperately looking for that 11th bracelet. And if you only have to be...
I would think Phil Ivey would be in it as well.
I would think so, too. But, of course, it's easy for us to tell other people what they should do with $1 million.
Right.
Neither Phil has asked me recently for investment advice. This is kind of interesting in the news. There's this house in Tennessee that burned down a couple days ago. The fire department got there in time, but the fire department just sat and watched it burn. Apparently, in that rural community, there's a rule that if you want fire coverage, you pay $75 a year, and if you pay that, you get... the fire department will cover you. If you don't pay it, it won't. And so homeowner hadn't.
Yeah, this right. Know? This is the second time this has happened in the last year or two, and I just find it unconscionable. I mean, to watch somebody's home burn down, you know. I mean, if what I think they should have done is, you know, charge the guy some higher amount of money, what it actually cost for the fire department to go out there and fight the fire, but don't just let his home burn to the ground. I mean,
well, you'd think so. Apparently, there is a provision for that. It was something like $2,000 to get there and $1,000 an hour thereafter, or some such number. And apparently, the homeowner didn't have his Visa card or something. But so there is a provision for that if they're there. But if they homeowners at work or something and not available to write that check.
Now, I remember in the last case, the homeowner was there and begging them and told them, look, I will pay, you know, I'll pay $5,000, whatever you want, just put the fire out. Now, in this case, I don't know what happened, but, you know, they interviewed the guy, you know, the homeowner, and he said, well, they didn't pay the $75 fee because they didn't think it would ever happen to them, you know. Now, admittedly, I mean, as gamblers, we're all basically in the same business as insurance companies. I mean, insurance is usually a bad bet. But, you know, in this case, I don't know. I think I would have paid the $75, even if it's a bad bet.
Yeah, there's some... Yeah, I would think so. I'm
willing to give up some EV, right? I mean, negative EV on the $75 is...
Yeah, it's like, you know, I assume you have various types of insurance on your home. And so even though those are not technically good bets, losing your home is such a catastrophe, you know, potentially a catastrophe that you you pay a little bit. All right, let's... Bob Loeb is on the line. He is a defense lawyer from Chicago, formerly an assistant state's attorney in Cook County. He's also spent time editing legal newsletters. He's an adjunct professor at DePaul University of Law and has written numerous articles on a variety of legal subjects. Pertinent to our show, one of his specialties is gambling law. He's co-written with I. Nelson Rose the book Blackjack and the Law, which deals with the rights of players in casinos, taxes, searches, barrings, and privacy in the gambling arena. Robert Loeb, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Hey, guys. How are you?
I'm well. Should I call you Robert or Bob?
Bob works for me.
All right. You're Bob number two, because I have to be Bob number one. That's just, anyway, good. Glad you're here.
I defer to the higher authority.
Yeah, I have the mute button, so you have to agree with me. All right.
Okay.
One of your recent cases dealt with players hole carding in a Michigan Indian casino. Tell us about that, including what hole carding is. And, let's start us there.
Okay. Hole carding, I should start out by saying, is a legal practice for players. It refers to viewing what is the hole card of a dealer in blackjack. By that I mean this. When playing blackjack, a dealer gets two cards. One of them is exposed. The other one is the hole card. It is not exposed. You might call it the down card. Okay. Once in a while, a dealer will inadvertently, either on one given hand or on a large percentage of hands, deal the cards in such a way as to expose that card to players at the table. The players at the table are not cheating in that they are receiving a view of that whole card passively. It's the agent of the casino, the dealer, who's showing them the whole card, and that gives them extra knowledge that helps the play of the hand when they can see the whole card. So, those are the circumstances, it's legal to play a hole card game.
Legal where?
It's legal everywhere in the United States in that there are no prohibitions on hole card play per se.
Okay.
To the extent, now, every jurisdiction, every state has its own law, and for what it's worth, every Indian casino has its own laws. Sometimes a few Indian casinos within a given tribe may share a set of laws with each other. But essentially, each state has its own, each casino in Indian country has its own laws. Now, a precedent, in other words, a legal decision in one state or one particular casino is not binding on another one. But the reality is Nevada is the leading casino jurisdiction, both in terms of, you know, number of years, number of casinos, and all that. And until, what was it, the late 1980s, there were really only two jurisdictions that had legalized gambling within the country, those being Nevada and New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And so most law in this area stems from Nevada and to a small, lesser extent, New Jersey. So in the early 1980s, Nevada had an opportunity to deal with hole carding, not just the concept of hole carding, wherein one player gets to view the hole card that the dealer has. But this case, and it's called Nevada versus Einbinder and Dalbin, this case involved a team or two partners, both playing blackjack at the same table. One of them had the better view of the dealer's exposed hole card and signaled to the other either the value of the card or how to play a particular hand based on the value of the whole card. Basically, what the team concept does is it camouflages who might be receiving this information, in that the spotter is looking at the exposed whole card, and the player who would be using the information betting large is getting his information from the spotter, but not particularly paying attention to the hole card. So my point is, Einbinder and Dalvin in Nevada dealt with this situation, and it dealt with the sophisticated version of a hole card game involving two players where one signals to the other.
All right, let's cut to the Michigan case.
Okay.
So
identical facts. But I should end the Nevada case with the Nevada Supreme Court saying this is legal. It's the casino's responsibility to police itself.
Okay.
Okay? Now, absolutely identical facts in Michigan. As a matter of fact, the prosecution stipulated that these were identical facts.
Well, before we get to the case, what actually happened? Were they their money was confiscated, or they were arrested? What actually happened?
Okay. The casino authorities and then security moved in on them. They confiscated the chips, tens of thousands of chips. And initially, right away, they didn't bring criminal charges. They actually consulted with the United States attorney that had federal jurisdiction over crimes, felonies that would be committed in this
Were
particular
they holding the players? Were they holding the players at this point? Or
no,
the players
were
allowed to leave?
They detained the players for, I'm going to guess, an hour and a half. Having seized these, attempting to interview the players and taking the chips and sending them on their way. So criminal charges were not brought right away. The U.S. Attorney's Office declined to bring charges. They are under no obligation to say why or issue anything official, but they declined to bring charges. And then the tribal authorities brought misdemeanor charges against these guys, these two players, the charge was called cheating. Cheating was not particularly well defined, wasn't really defined at all. So it was just prosecution and the casino chose to consider that cheating. The two players obviously did not consider it cheating, and it was up to the judge to decide whether or not it was cheating. And as I say, cheating was not particularly defined, and certainly no prohibition on hole card play specifically. Now I suppose you want to know what happened on the case.
Wait. Let me ask you one more question first. You said that each Indian jurisdiction has their own set of laws. Now, if
Correct.
I'm going to go play in, say, Mississippi, I can look up exactly what the laws of Mississippi are. Is that true of Indian sovereign nations? Can I look up their laws ahead of time?
Well, in this particular case, if you look carefully enough, if you know where to look, yeah, they are online on the website of the tribal nation, not the casino per se. You could theoretically find them, but in this particular case, they wouldn't have told you a lot. I mean, doesn't it make sense that cheating, whatever that means, is going to be illegal everywhere? It would be good.
Well, yeah, but there should be a legal definition of it.
You're preaching to the choir now. That's exactly what I argue.
Right.
So they didn't get their money back?
Not yet. Now, that's the money itself is in the hands of the Tribal Gaming Commission. We haven't completely finished with that, but they initially were declining to give money back. There may still well be a dispute as to how much of the money seized the players brought to the table with them, because right now that has been seized that's part of the chips that they had in front of them, and that was seized. It's part of the 30-some-odd thousand.
So are we talking about, what, $5,000 to $10,000? Is that what we're talking about approximately?
We're talking about or close to $10,000 being the amount that they would have brought in chips or cash that they used to buy chips. We're talking a total of close to $35,000 in chips that were seized off the table.
Uh-huh, of which 25 probably represented winnings.
Right.
All right.
So you said that you're still what, negotiating with the tribal gaming commission?
Well, there's been the criminal misdemeanor trial, and the judge found them guilty of cheating and fined them. He did not incarcerate them. Okay.
And how much was the fine?
$490 each, and don't ask me how we arrived at that odd number. I don't know.
That's an even number, but go ahead.
I stand corrected. We are dealing with numbers tonight. It is both.
So 490, but the court didn't say what about the confiscated chips? That they didn't.
Well,
there was no
court. The court really doesn't have the jurisdiction over the chips. The court has the jurisdiction over the criminal offense, and the gaming board has the jurisdiction over the chips seized by the gaming officials. So it's technically two different cases. Now, let's be real-world realists here. The gaming board is not going to be eager to return the $35,000 in chips to these two individuals. Okay? They've declined to return any of it so far. Okay? So, and I am not suggesting that we in any way are getting a fair shake out of all this. But the fact that the court has found them guilty of cheating is likely to lead the casino in front of the gaming commission to claim that at the very least $25,000 of the $35,000 is ill-gotten, and actually they may be taking the position that the whole $35,000 is subject to seizure and not being returned.
Is there any appeal to this tribal court?
Theoretically, perhaps. On the other hand, and again, in the real world, there is little reason to believe that the tribal courts are going to be any more reasonable than the trial court was in finding them guilty. As a matter of fact, in the general sense, tribal justice, in my experience, is kind of a non sequitur. It's kind of like they make the rules as they go along, and they don't seek justice anywhere near as much as we do in the regular courts. And I'm not the biggest fan of gaming law decisions in the regular courts.
Is there no non-tribal? I mean, are they really sovereign in that there's, I mean, let's say that I owned a business, you know, and I did business with the tribe, and they basically screwed me completely some way in a business deal. Is there no recourse for a U.S. citizen against a tribe that doesn't, that circumvents the tribal court?
Tough to give you a broad answer to that. Every single casino that we have in the tribal casino that we have in the United States begins with a compact, which is essentially an agreement, a contract between the tribe and the federal government, or you might call it their licensing papers. Okay?
Okay.
And every contract or compact varies. It depends on what the parties negotiate as to the extent of the sovereignty. There isn't a single general answer. Sometimes the tribes have the right to decide these things in their own courts. Other times, we have to go to the state or the federal courts to resolve those kinds of issues.
Has anybody sorted through all the compacts and said, here are the Indian tribes where you can get where you're going to get screwed, and here are the Indian tribes where you have a shot with a U.S. court?
And here are the ones we don't know about yet.
Yeah, it's like that'd be a very valuable list to have.
It would be. During my copious free time, I'd love to compile that sometime. I'm not aware that anybody has compiled it, and I suspect that, as Bob just suggested, the largest group of that would be the ones that we just haven't really determined yet, whether or not they are kind of autonomous and the extent to which they're autonomous and the extent to which they strive to do justice or not.
Most people would consider whole carding to be pushing the envelope a little bit. It may be legally, but pushing the envelope. If somebody was going to be playing some kind of casino game at an advantage, pushing the envelope in that sense or some other, would you strongly recommend not playing in an Indian casino?
I would strongly recommend against pushing the envelope at an Indian casino. Now, I would suggest, based on this decision, that an individual playing a whole card game without doing the signaling might fare much better. I think it's the combination of the whole card and the signaling that led this particular judge to say that that is cheating. But on the other hand, yeah, I'm going to take a rather conservative approach to challenging authority at Indian casinos. I don't see individuals doing well there. They make up the rules. As I get complaints from people around the country, the number of times, and this doesn't have to come from blackjack, this could come from video poker players with an advantage, the number of times that people are getting kicked out of their rooms, even if they've been comped, because they've engaged in advantage play, the number of times that comps have been canceled, the number of times chips or money have been seized, the number of times that they're just plain mistreated, the number of times that they're followed by police officers and stopped when leaving there. An inordinate percentage come from Indian casinos. And let me throw in one disclaimer. As I view it, I don't want anybody taking this as being racist or this is my view of Native Americans. What makes them unique is that they've got a casino and they're unregulated and they get to make their own rules. And if you took any other ethnic group and gave them a casino, the lack of regulation and the power to make their own rules, I think it would come out the same way. So having thrown out that disclaimer, you had a question, Richard.
Yeah, it seems to me that there are a lot of incidents of the Indian casinos seeming to have local police, not tribal police, but actual state police or whatever the nearby town is, in their pocket. And often players are identified by their license plates. They must be getting DMV info. As you mentioned, you'll drive off the reservation and immediately get pulled over by police, and the police are just there really to find out who you are, get your name, get your ID, and report back to the casino. I mean, how is that going on? Why is that going on? And is there anything that can be done to stop that?
Well, the answer to why it's going on is pretty simple. Because they can. That's part of not being regulated. From what I've seen, I've seen different combinations.
Are the police getting money for the? Because these are not tribal police. I'm talking about these are, you know,
right, village, town, county, sheriff, whatever. Yeah, yeah. or state police. Again, we get back to those compacts. Sometimes they might be off-duty policemen who are contracted with the police. You know, sometimes they're just glorified security officers. In other cases, and I don't know the answer, in many of these cases, the tribe may well be paying the town, the village, or even the state to provide police services on their properties and even on their roads. In other cases, I'm going to guess that that the tribes or the casinos themselves may not be actually paying per se for police protection, but rather it might be part of the formula of how much money they're in effect being taxed. And we don't even necessarily have to call it a tax. Sometimes it's just the rights to have a casino. But however that's worked out, there's a financial arrangement. And I guess moving on to the next question that you might be asking, is that proper for them to do so? There's nothing improper about, in effect, hiring the local police force to serve as your police as well. So, yeah.
You had mentioned to me that there was a case, I think, in Indiana where players had chips confiscated, and that's not an Indian casino. Could we talk about that some?
Sure. Virtually identical factual situation. Two guys playing as partners at a blackjack table, one spotting the whole card, signaling to the other who's playing the big money. In that particular case, it was an arrest just of the one who was playing the big money, not the one who was the spotter. And they had, Indiana has a statute that many states have now, which makes it, in effect, a form of cheating, but specifically a crime, to place a bet after acquiring knowledge that is not available to all other players. Now, just like cheating was a vague statute in the Michigan Indian Casino, this is a very vague statute. I've done some research. The best that I can come up with is this statute, placing a bet after acting on information not available to all players, was either to attack collusion between a cheating dealer who is just communicating information to a partner who's a player, or it stemmed from sports betting and inside information and a fixed sporting event. Both seem to be real possibilities. But the state of Indiana chose to apply it to two blackjack players sitting at a table who are smart enough, savvy enough, and observant enough to view a hole card, and saying that was information that might not be available to other players. This is, again, a vague law which should be unconstitutional, but it is ridiculous in its application, and let me give you this example. If I'm sitting at a blackjack table alone, and I'm viewing the whole card, or with a partner, and I'm viewing the whole card and signaling to the partner, but either I or my partner and I are the only players at the table, then that activity would be 100% legal under this definition that says information available to all the players. So I'm playing for a half an hour. It's entirely legal. And then out of the blue, some other player sits down and joins us. On the next hand, if I've got that information and the other player doesn't, suddenly that same activity by me becomes a felony. There is no way that the legislature ever intended that.
Even a no hole carding, just a flat card counter. who has information that a non-card counter doesn't, that law would make that a felony. Or in my case, a video poker player that I know how to play a particular five cards and the next guy over doesn't, I suspect I'd be committing a felony in Indiana.
Well, by the casino's interpretation and this particular prosecutor, yes.
All right, so we don't play at Indian casinos and we don't play at Indiana. Is there any other place we shouldn't play?
No, wait a minute. So what happened in that case? How much money did they confiscate and what ended up happening?
Ironically, a very similar amount, about $33,000. They seized the money. They charged the player with a felony. Okay? Now, a felony conviction, this happens to have been a well-educated person in a field where one might get state or national licensing, for instance, like an insurance salesman has to be licensed, okay? But a felony conviction could prevent them from getting a job in that field. So you've got somebody charged with a felony whose entire career is at stake by this ridiculous charge, okay? And I moved to find the statute unconstitutional. Unconstitutional is applied to this guy. I moved to for the judge to find it void for vagueness. Judge put off ruling on those. And as we were preparing for trial, the state, in an attempt to save face, agreed to lower the charges, not just to a misdemeanor, but a petty offense. They're going to call it disorderly conduct. They didn't even say what was disorderly, with a nothing fine. Literally zero. No jail time, no probation, but rather a deferred prosecution, which was essentially, don't get into any trouble for 6 months, and we'll wipe this off the record.
And we'll give you back
and
your 33.
And they got their money back. Yeah, right. Nope. $33,000.
There's a lawsuit, a separate civil lawsuit pending over that. They kept the money.
Wow. Scary.
Now, it's frustrating to me. I would have loved to have tried this case because I think that you take this one through responsible courts and the charges would actually have to be dismissed. But how does somebody who has a responsible white-collar career basically gamble that he will get that outcome, and no matter what the long shot chance of a conviction is, he loses his entire career as a result.
It's pretty serious stuff.
You take the slap on the wrist, you know.
If they knocked it down to that, what is their justification for keeping the money?
That's what we're asking the civil court to determine. I would say none.
Right. Yeah.
And particularly in light of the Chen case in the state of Nevada, which said even if somebody was doing something that was improper, if it did not cause the guy, if the allegedly illegal conduct, in this case disorderly conduct, had nothing to do with the accumulation of the profits, then the state can't keep it. But we will see which way they go.
It seems like the trend in Nevada has gotten so much better for the players. Casinos are pulling a lot less shenanigans than they used to, it seems. I guess mainly because of, the Grossstein cases. But it seems
and other cases brought by Bob Recession.
Yeah, there are others, yes. But it seems like the rest of the country is going crazy, confiscating people's money and locking them up. I mean, where do you think this is going?
And before you answer that, you got 2 minutes. And then we're going to have to cut you off. All right, go.
Okay, fair enough. It will continue to go the way of the casinos, the way of the police, the way of the gaming boards until somebody stands up to them and truly litigates, and sometimes it can be more expensive than what it's worth to litigate. The people who litigate are heroes, but they will continue to get away with it until somebody puts a stop to it in the courts, and I think we've got 60 seconds to spare.
All right. Your practice is based in Chicago and the surrounding areas.
It is. Yep.
For a gambling case, if a player, say, in Denver needed a gaming attorney, would that be too far for you to go?
It's not so much that it's too far for me to go. There are not that many cases that makes it worthwhile for me to travel, charge the fees that it would take to put in that kind of time. Plus, I'm only licensed in a couple states in the federal courts. Better to get a local gambling lawyer in most cases.
All right. So if an Illinois player had a gambling problem and wanted to get in touch with you, how would they do that?
I'm listed in the books. They would call me or email me or go to my website.
RobertLoeb.com.
Yep.
Very good. Thank you very much.
RobertLoeb.com?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Very educational. And we'll be talking to you again, hopefully soon.
My pleasure. Let's do it again sometime.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bob.
All right, Munchkin, what did we learn?
Boy, we learned it's scary out there. It's scary out there. Those are not good things happening. I mean, the Indiana case really surprises me because, you know, they're not Indian casinos, and I can't believe they're still hanging on to that money. I don't see how they think they can get away with that. We need James Grosstein to go get in trouble out there so that he can sue them.
let's ask James Grosstein to go commit a fine. Good.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about James is, you know, it's not about the money. It's about, you know, teaching them a lesson. You know, he will keep going until he gets what he wants.
Well, good. We need more heroes like that. Let's talk about our sponsors. The South Point has more than 10,000 video poker games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else. From now until Christmas Eve, many outlets at South Point are 50% off when you use your slot club points, including bars, restaurants, hotel, lots of things. They do this every year. So a lot of players save their points all year long to spend them in December, where they basically get double money for their points. Double points in December will be happening on Christmas Day, midnight to midnight. Save me a spot on the Quick Quads machine. National Finals Rodeo is going on at the Thomas and Mack, but from now until the 10th, which is Saturday, they're having a similar event at South Point. It's the World Series of Team Roping. It's at the South Point Arena. It's totally free. And if you want a rodeo experience, it's not the rodeo, but it's very similar. We're going to be having another semester of video poker class. This is starting at the South Point, beginning the first week of January. We haven't worked out whether it's going to be Tuesday or Wednesday, but it's going to be one of those two, the first week of January, going for 10 weeks. We will keep you posted. At the Palms, the play, earn, and win prizes at the Palms usually happen Monday, Wednesday, Friday, but in December it happens on Sunday. The theme is Wrap It Up. It relates to Christmas wrapping stuff. From now until December 23rd, you can earn additional gift cards. You need to cash them in by December 23rd. It is at a very low rate, 0.04, but it's additive to other things. So on Mondays through Fridays through December 16th, you get extra cash back for your play, and that's earned at a 0.33% rate. So what that means is you play $3,000 and you get back $10 in cash. You can earn up to $280 a day, which means $84,000 in coin in. And that's added to the gift card you're going to get. So this is more than double points. It's like halfway between double points and triple points. And it's a good deal. So a lot of us are going to be playing extra lot in December, because the the Palms is paying us to do so. Many casinos have good deals in December. It's a good time to be a video poker player. Munchkin, who are we going to have next week?
Next week, we are going to have Casey Carlston. And Casey is a...
Is that a name or initials?
Those are initials.
Okay.
Casey.
Okay.
It's a city. Casey was a professional blackjack player. And when he found it difficult to play blackjack, he took up Advantage Craps. Where he won $1.5 million and then lost it all back. And now is of the opinion that he was deluding himself and never had an edge when he was playing craps. But I want to make it clear that this is not just some random gambler. This is a smart Advantage player, you know, played blackjack professionally. And he also has some really interesting stories about gambling on the Internet back before that became difficult to do in the U.S., so we'll talk about Advantage plays on the Internet as well.
Good. It sounds interesting.
Yeah.
Following week, we're going to have a tax guy, my tax accountant. His name's Spike. We're going to have some
Spike.
Spike. His name is Frank Gallus, but for some reason we call him Spike, and I'm not sure why. I suppose we could ask him. I had other accountants dealing with, and I come in and I just send in millions of dollars with the W-2Gs, and they don't get it right. So Spike handles it well. He has about 10% of his clients are professional gamblers. And so if you have a significant income from gambling, he's someone who's good to know. So we're going to be meeting him in 2 weeks. And in 3 weeks, we usually
I just want to say, I think that's really good that we're going to do this before the end of the year so we can talk about things people should do before the end of the year to prepare for their taxes for next year.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be definitely one of the questions. And the following week, we're having Don Johnson. This is not a Hollywood actor, but he's a he played blackjack in Atlantic City. He got the casinos to give him deals and came up $15 million ahead. And he's willing to come on the show and tell us about that. There's one or two of us who wouldn't mind being $15 million ahead if we had the chance.
Right.
So anyway, that's going to be on the 29th. All right. Richard, you had a conversation with Mike Shackelford recently, who suggested you become a gambling consultant.
Yeah, he recommended that I become a gambling consultant. And,
how would
you
know,
that
go
down? Idea is,
mm-hmm.
Well, the idea is that somebody who comes to Las Vegas with a big line of credit, like a guy with a $100,000 line of credit or more, that I would basically teach him how to improve his gambling skills and save him a lot of money in the process. And in addition, you know, negotiate with the casinos for better cash back deals and perks, et cetera. So I thought that was an interesting idea. I think I could definitely save a guy a lot of money who's just a civilian, you know, a civilian gambler type. I'm not going to try to turn anybody into a professional gambler. I'm just going to try to make him, you know, make better gambling choices and try to save money in the process.
So
all you listeners out there with million-dollar lines.
So you could easily save one of these people 10 or 20,000 or more a trip, and over the course of the year could easily be in the hundreds of thousands.
Yeah. Now, you do some of this consulting, right, for video poker?
I do, but not on the. I haven't had any with $100,000 lines of credit so far. The I actually have two different consulting things that I do. One is an hourly rate. I charge $250 an hour and 2 hour minimum, and they come and we usually teach them how to play a better game, whatever game they want to learn the fine points of. We'll spend time learning, and I have a dozen or so players a year who come in and do that. There's another form that I didn't really plan to get into, but I happened to. People kept asking me, where do I play video poker? And they're just really curious. And these people normally would not be playing $25 machines or even higher machines that I play, but they really want to know where Bob Dancer plays. So I wrote an article and said, all right, for $5,000, I will tell you where I play. Every play, I won't hold anything out. And I'm figuring that is way out of the budget of anybody who wanted to know. But I did get one taker. That weekend, they had hit a $40,000 royal flush and a $20,000 aces with a kicker hand. It was on a lousy pay schedule. It was on 9-5 double-double, which is under 98%. But since they'd hit the two big jackpots, they figured they had finally figured out gambling, and so now they were ready to go for the big time, so they were going to invest $5,000 and learn Bob Dancer's secrets. Well, I told them. I mean, they paid me, and I told them where I played, but they had no capability whatsoever of playing this particular game at this casino and that particular game at this casino and this particular game at that casino. They had no idea that 9-5 double-double bonus was a really awful game, and were quite shocked when I told them that as far as they were concerned, their jackpots were huge, and they were up 47,000 on the weekend, and that meant that was the bottom line as far as they were concerned. So nobody else had decided it was worth that much to them, which is fine with me. Some of these plays, I don't need competition.
Right.
So,
I mean, it's a shame because I'm sure that if they were playing a game that bad normally, if they had just taken your advice, they probably would have paid for itself pretty quickly if they were switching to other games that were over 99%.
Oh yeah, and you know, and all my plays are over 100%, including everything. And learning how to include those things is part of what it's all about. That's part of what you would share in your knowledge of how to include these other things, how to, you know, what to do to the casino to get them to give you a special deal or to evaluate your comp situation differently. But they liked the way the casino treated them because the casino was, they're playing a 98% game and come in and on average lose 30,000 every trip they come in. And the casino treated them like royalty, as well they should. You come into my store and lose $30,000 every time, I'll treat you pretty good too. All right, so you got your Christmas stuff done? We got 1 minute to go.
I have a wife, so I don't have to do those Christmas things anymore. She does them for me.
Oh, that's good reason to keep her.
I have the greatest wife in the world, so.
Well, mine's taller than yours. I suspect Shirley dances better than yours. Good. I'm happy, and having somebody do those things is good. All's I need to worry about Shirley, what to get Shirley, and she handles everything else, which is good. Very good. We got 5 seconds to go, so I want everybody to hit lots of royal flushes, and we'll see you next week.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.